Hello. An hour. Today will be dedicated to the music of the prominent Israeli composer Ari Shapira. A very long program, as it is a very prolific and long composition life that this composer has given us, one of Israel's most extreme and most extraordinary composers, and hence a long program. I'm very glad to have Ari Shapira with me today.
Thank you.
Hello, Ari.
Hello.
And from now on, I will call you Arik, as I'm used to.
Okay.
And for those listeners abroad, don't get scared. Arik is a common name in Hebrew. Just a short bio for Ari Shapira. For those of you who don't know, Ari Shapira was born on November 29th, 1943, at Kibbutz Afikim. This is in the Jordan Valley, 3 kilometers south of the Kinneret, which is the Sea of Galilee. In 1947, his family moved to Petah Tikva, where he began to learn the piano. Under whom, Ari Shapira?
David Yassel.
David Yassel.
Yes, he was a very good teacher, mind you.
Upon completion of his high school studies, he was accepted by the University of Tel Aviv to study philosophy. This was from 1962 to 1965. In 1963, he began to study composition at the Academy of Music in Tel Aviv. Amongst his teachers were Odin Partosh. Did I say that correctly? Odin Partosh.
Udin Partosh.
Udin Partosh. In English, it doesn't make any sense. Udin Partosh, Mordechai Setter, Arthur Gelbrun, and Abel Ehrlich. Arik Shapira completed his studies at the Academy of Music in 1968. In 1986, he received the Prime Minister Prize for Composition, and in 1994, he was awarded the Israel Prize for Composition and Teaching, which I should say is the highest recognition that an Israeli composer can actually receive.
Yes, it is.
Shapira composes electronic music, symphonic music, chamber music, and music for solo instruments. From 1995 onwards, till this day, actually, he teaches in the Faculty of Music at the University of Haifa. I would like, of course, as always, to start with a musical snippet before we even start speaking with Arik himself about his music. This is going to be something that's been heard on the radio before, and the reason I mention this is because most of the pieces we'll be hearing on this program have not been heard. This will be a radiophonic debut for most of them. But this piece, Misa Viva, it's from 1977 for Symphony Orchestra and Rock Band. I see it as a calling card almost for you, Arik Shapira, because first of all, a symphonic piece, a very large piece and probably one of your largest, and the piece that allowed you to come to the recognition of Europe and the world. Up until then, you were more known in Israel.
Yes, it is. The piece was performed in ISCM, and since I was the first Israeli to be performed there, it made a lot of noise.
And since then, was your connection with Europe something that was more ongoing?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It opened a lot of doors in Europe.
And I think I can understand why. So let's listen to Misa Viva, just to allow our listeners to understand a bit of the style and the music of Arik Shapira.
Thank you.
Misa Viva for Symphony Orchestra and Rock Band. That was the Krakow Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Wojciech Wiśniewski. Right. And this was the premiere recording of the ISCM in 1982. This was in Graz, Austria. This was a submission that you made yourself, if I'm...
Yes, I sent it personally.
Right.
And it was the surprise was that it was accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it's an old story.
It is indeed.
Yes.
But I would not like to dedicate too many words to Misa Viva, of course, because you've talked about this before. But I think that it captures something of this the musical style that you have, something of what fascinates you in music, and I think that's very important. But the next piece that we will listen to is, of course, from years later. This is Lute 2004. And this is, of course, already something that's completely different. I think that after Misa Viva, you have stopped almost completely writing symphonic music. Am I right in saying that?
I found out that the big symphonic orchestra is not made for me. I don't need so much performers. And that's why, that's the reason why I concentrate on chamber music.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest orchestra I use now is 25 or 23 performers. That's all.
So from my personal knowledge, what you in fact do is that you you divide, or you take the sections, the big sections. So for instance, 12 violins, you prefer to write for a solo instrument instead of a section.
Yes.
Why is this?
Because when a section is playing, let's say a melody, you hear so much melodies going together in parallel,
mm-hmm.
because it's not sharp, it's not blunt enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's too fat for me, the sound of a group.
So the section masks the sound.
Yes.
And there's something that you would rather it be blunt and straightforward.
Yes. And right. I adore the solo violin.
Mm.
I don't need the group, I need one.
I see. But is there no chance that Arik Shapiro will write another symphonic piece?
No.
No.
There is no chance.
Okay.
Whatsoever.
Ah, that's a shame. Lute 2004, of course, is a very strange piece to start with, because, of course, this is for an instrument that you don't usually, or a group of instruments that you don't usually write for, which is an instrument which is out of date.
Yes, it's a real obsolete instrument, even funny.
Mm.
But I know a guy from Haifa who plays the lute,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted a piece. And it occurred to me that I need electronic just to save that passé instrument, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I did it.
What is exactly the communication or the connection between the electronics and the live instrument?
The playback is, as always, with me, is, let's say, sampled lute.
Mm-hmm.
And it's audible both by the player and by the audience, and it plays according to the notes in the playback.
Mm-hmm. So, in fact, the playback and the live player are playing supposedly the same parts, almost.
In some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And what interested me is the relation between the real sound and the alienated sound of the digital lute,
mm-hmm.
and
or a sampled lute, in fact.
Yes, sampled lute.
Yeah,
and the tension, the performer has to follow the playback, and the playback is very complicated rhythmically,
mm-hmm.
and he can't really do it,
mm-hmm.
and that's the reason why I do it just to get the uneasiness of the performance, so to speak.
Very interesting.
I need it just to convey the message,
right,
of Israeli atmosphere.
Huh, very interesting. So let us listen now to Lute 2004. This is Ori Harmelin playing the lute. Ori studies now in Trossingen, Germany, and is a very, very talented lute player from Haifa, actually, where you live, where we both come from, in fact.
Yes.
This was a studio recording made where? Here in Israel.
In this room.
In this room, here in, yes, Haifa. Fantastic. So let us listen to Lute 2004 now. Ari Shapira. Thank you. 2004, that was Ori Haumelin playing the lute here in a studio recording in Haifa. A very interesting question that arises for me when I listen to this piece, as I know that it is a part of a group of pieces that you wrote using the same, let's call it compositional technique for the lack of a better description, which is there is a tape part and there is a live player, and they seem to correspond microtonally, let's say. The tape part plays microtones or some kind of deviation.
Out of tune.
Yeah.
Yes.
And of course, this creates a very specific sound. I know that you've done this with guitar. You've done this with saxophones or string quartet as well?
In string quartet, yes. As well.
So this is obviously something that's very interesting for you. But one thing that you recounted to me, this was in 2006. We were both in The Hague, where the Royal Conservatory decided to honor you with a series of concerts. At the time, a piece called Ex Machina was played, which is basically the same compositional idea, but for guitar and tape. And later, in a conversation, you had told me that something about the performance was very dead. And this was actually because the performer in this concert managed to play with noticeable ease what you have written down in the score. I should mention that you, to me, said that the first performance given by Reuven Sarussi was much more agitated.
Yes.
Reuven being, of course, a maturer or from a different generation of players and composers.
And much older.
Exactly.
Than the boy in The Hague.
So this makes me ask a question. Of course, this means that as time goes by, your music is going to become easier for performers to attack, to perform. And to you, does this mean that some of the validity of the playing will actually be lost, or the validity of the composition will be lost?
I don't really know. I can't tell. But generally speaking, I prefer the uneasy playing, mm-hmm. the embarrassed player facing the playback. And that example from Haag, mm-hmm. he was young and he reacted perfectly to the playback,
mm-hmm.
and it was a bit. I didn't want it to sound like that.
Mm.
I wanted to be agitated.
But it was a clean performance. It was a better performance, and in your ears in your perception, it was actually.
A less
interesting performance,
yes.
Just because of that.
Yes.
And this is interesting because I think that as we go along, the listeners, I of course know this, but the listeners will notice that this is something that you discuss a lot with performers, or that you try to write for a lot, which is this uneasy feeling you try to give psychologically to a performer in order for these to actually be agitated or to be to give a performance which is not clean. And hence capture something of the sound that you're trying to create, this Israeli sound, this dry sound.
Yes. It's not the sound, it's the atmosphere.
Interesting.
That's uneasiness and out of tune parts of the different pieces.
Interesting. The next piece that we'll listen to is in fact very much similar. Is this related to the same compositional technique, or is this something different?
Yes, it's the same. It's a sampled violin playing together with a live violin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find it appropriate, so to speak, to take, let's say, a playback of drums, of percussion playback,
right,
with a flute. It's meaningless for me.
Mm-hmm.
If I write for a flute and a playback, I would write for a flute. And the sampled flute.
And a sample of a flute. Why is that?
Because I like the tiny differences between. I don't like big contrast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not European. Hmm. I don't belong to the 19th century.
Hmm.
I don't accept the big forte with the soft piano.
Hmm.
I don't like high pitch melody. In contrast to low pitch melody, that direction is not for me.
So it's the extreme contrast that remind you of a musical period that you're not connected to.
Yes.
But when you listen to other, I mean, there are a lot of composers these days that write pieces acousmatic or tape pieces with live performers that do exactly that. Is it something that you cannot relate to, or do you only in your own music feel that this is the way that you've taken?
Well, I it's the wrong way. It doesn't solve anything. It's just abusing electronic.
Hmm.
That's all.
Hmm.
I don't like it.
Violin 2007, that was Gilad Hildesheim on the violin, and the electronic soundtrack was made here in your own studio, or?
No, I don't have the facility here.
Mm-hmm.
I go to a former student of mine, Guy Barash.
Yes, who's now in New York City.
Yes, and yes. he's also from Haifa, and I did it at his studio.
Right. Well, we should mention Guy Barash in that case, who, for the lack of a better word, was the technician.
Yes.
But he was much, much more, of course. The next piece that we're going to be dealing with is called Saxophone Quartet with Electronics. A bit of history about this piece, as it is a second to the first saxophone quartet, which was called...
Saxophone Quartet.
Saxophone Quartet, yes. Simply. And that was commissioned by the Stockholm Saxophone Quartet.
Yes.
This is, of course, for a Swedish saxophone quartet who gave a monumental performance of this piece and recorded it. It was in 1996 here. Yes. In...
No, it was in 1998.
The piece itself was written in 96 and yes. The performance was 98 in the Tel Aviv Museum.
Yes, in Israel.
In Israel.
They played it all over Europe. In South America and even Africa, South Africa.
Right. Well, indeed a fantastic piece, one of my favorite pieces, and something that I remember you telling me, or not me specifically, but this was in a class that you gave once, in which you realized that this first saxophone quartet is actually the spoken Hebrew language.
Yes.
And it's a very interesting manifestation on your behalf.
I take the rhythm from the Hebrew language. So to speak, as it should be, mm-hmm. if you ask me. And when I listen to the piece, I suddenly realize that they speak Hebrew.
Huh. So this was not a process that you went through while composing. You actually, in retrospect, listened yes. to it and realized this.
Yes.
It's very interesting.
It happens here and there.
Mm.
When after listening to the piece, you realize what you've actually done.
Mm. Is any of that apparent in the second quartet, the saxophone quartet that we're going to listen to now?
No.
No, it's a different kind of issue.
Well, it might be. I'm not that aware of it.
Okay. It's interesting, because this was also a commission from the same saxophone quartet. After you had written the first one for them, they were obviously very happy with it, had commissioned the second one.
Yes.
This one was written 2001. Was it performed by the Swedish
Yes, they performed it. Yes.
But this recording that we have here, of course, is with the Israel Saxophone Quartet. But this is also for tape, and I wonder, is the tape relating in the same manner again to the saxophone quartet? This is a sample?
Sampled the saxophone quartet and a real quartet, live quartet. And I must add that each... performer is supposed to follow his track,
mm-hmm.
and that's the reason why they had all earphones, and each performer listening to his part,
mm-hmm.
which he had to relate to.
Relate to as a cue, for as instance, a cue yes. mechanism.
But both are audible, both groups, so to speak.
So let me just clarify this for myself. The players are actually listening to, on headphones, a sample of their own saxophone,
yes.
which is being played to the audience.
Yes.
And they are supposed to be cued in specific parts of the score,
yes.
according to the tape in their ear.
Yes.
And this, of course, again, to create this kind of agitated relationship.
Yes.
It's very interesting. The sound world, interestingly enough, in this quartet is very different than the one in the first. This is a full saxophone quartet. And the tape part is actually playing large parts of it. It's playing a unison of some sort with the live quartet. So in fact, you get a massive sound which is a mush between live saxophone and sampled saxophone, and you never know whether it's the actual saxophones, the live saxophones playing.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
I like this this area of no man's land, of gray. I don't like big dramas. I like small dramas, so to speak.
And this is probably why you also have your pieces are also very short in length, I must admit.
Yes, of course. I believe that each piece ought to be like a telegram. It's quick, like 21st century.
To state a point and get on with it.
Yes. We don't have time to a 70 minute symphony. It's too much for me, for you, for the young people.
For the young people, for sure. The younger they get.
Yes.
So here it is for you, Saxophone Quartet with Electronics. The Israel Saxophone Quartet performed this live in the Teiva.
Yes.
This was in which year, can you remember?
In 07.
2007.
Yes.
So here it is for you, Saxophone Quartet with Electronics, Arik Shapira.
Thank you.
Saxophone Quartet with Electronics, the Israeli Saxophone Quartet. This is a piece from 2001. Alex Shapira. The next piece that we will listen to is a piece that is already quite old. This is a piece from 1989, and the reason that I've decided to put this piece in with a bunch of pieces that are receiving their radiophonic premiere is because this piece is banned for performance in public Israeli radio. And this is why, Arik Shapira.
Well, it's a very political piece in Israel because it speaks against the settlements on the West Bank. Ofra is a very famous and radical and center of all the maniacs of the so-called Gush Emunim.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost a symbol for, yes, for the settlement movement.
Yes, it's one of the first. And I'm convinced that the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Golan Heights is immorally wrong to start with. Mm-hmm. And then it poses a danger to Israel, mm-hmm, morally, economically, and even its existence is in questions. Facing the problem of the Palestinians, it's so deep, it's so profound, and I don't see now a chance of solving it. And Israel will get into wars, into a chain of wars all over again, and that's not life.
And this piece, which is titled Upon Thy Ruins, Ofra, which is an electronic piece, but features recordings of the recorder, an instrument that is related to the past of Israeli folklore and culture, And this same recorder is actually playing folk tunes that that were Zionistic folk tunes of the beginning of Israel as a state.
No, even before that.
Even before.
Yes, it's from the 30s and the 20s.
Aha, uh-huh, so this is almost folklore that led...
Very old songs, all of them, so to say, Zionist tunes. And they symbolize the Zionist project.
But why was this actually banned? I mean, this piece had a few radio performances from 1989 up until 1995, when it was issued actually on a CD.
Yes, when it was issued, I was interviewed by the radio, and I told the audience that it will be performed on Ofra ruins on the first anniversary of its evacuation.
Mm-hmm. Which hasn't happened yet.
Yes, unfortunately. And a big scandal erupted. And for that reason, the manager of the radio decided to ban it.
What exactly happened?
Unknown man listened to my little speech and told a certain Knesset member called Shaul Yalom, who is no longer a Knesset member, and he started a project against me.
Interesting.
On the radio, on newspapers, on television, it was a real scandal. I can't say I didn't like it, but I was very much hurt because of that, because I was fired from the Music Academy in Tel Aviv.
As a part of this
issue? This scandal, yes, right. Because all the big bosses in the academy belonged to the right wing. All of them, interesting. Three of, at that time, it was in 97, and that the reason why I moved to Haifa University.
Mm-hmm. And this is interesting, actually, for me to mention, because in 1994, you received the Israel Prize, which is the highest... commendation that an Israeli composer can receive in Israel.
Well,
and usually it is given to people who are not in any way showing conflict, and you still were given this prize in 1994. I wonder, was this a fluke? Was this a mistake, you think, on behalf of the elites?
Well, I must remind you that it was during Rabin's reign, Rabin's government, and the atmosphere was euphoric in Israel at the time, and it was part of it that I don't belong to the establishment. I fight the music establishment in Israel, and there was also a big scandal when I got Israel Prize.
People were not accepting it as peacefully as you thought they would.
My colleagues mainly.
Right.
Because it was awarded for a quarter of a century. Suddenly I popped out as the winner, and they were so crazy, my colleagues.
Yes, and you were quite young at the time. How old were you?
I was 50 at the time.
Which is a very young age to be nominated for the Israel Prize.
Yes, Israel Prize are usually given to people over 80.
Very interesting. I think that it's also very interesting to note that Upon Thy Wounds, Ofra, is an acousmatic piece. It is related to trends, so to speak, of acousmatic music in the world. When somebody not an Israeli listens to this piece, of course they are completely unaware or cannot be aware of the political manifestation that you're trying to make or the implications in the piece. So in fact, this is a piece for Israelis.
Not only Israelis, but Israelis of a certain age.
Hmm.
Because young people don't know those songs. They are very old. Only my age and more and older can understand the piece fully.
it reminds me of another piece you have called Ilabi Ilabi, which is also a translation of a folk song, an Israeli folk song, into Arabic. So also something that I remember playing this to my mother, and my mother immediately understood the piece. It had nothing to do with the aesthetics. It had nothing to do with the way it's composed. She understood the contrast of taking almost a socialist Zionist song and then translating it into Arabic, making it, of course, something completely different. But this is, of course, a pleasure for me, and I'm sure that the Halas Network in general, to play something that's banned on Israeli radio at large, and especially a piece which I find as fantastic as Upon Thy Ruins, Ophrah. So here it is for you. This is from 1989 again. The recorders were performed by Yuda Gilad, a personal friend of yours.
Yes.
And this was done in the studio...
In Givatayim. It was at that time an analog studio.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So here it is, Upon Thy Ruins, Ophrah, Arik Shapiro.
Thank you. The second and last part of Ofir Ilzetsky's interview with the Israeli composer Ari Shapira will be brought to you on the next broadcast of an hour, which is an anechoic transmission brought to you by Radio Chalas.